DeSanto Propane is four generations strong as a trustworthy family-owned business with unmatched customer service. Go online at DeSantoPropane.com for more info or call toll-free at 1-800-752-4574. Since 1937, the difference has been DeSanto Propane.
Do you want to know what's happening in the Finger Lakes? We do too. We're going in depth with decision makers in the heart of upstate New York to get the answers you need. From the team of FingerLakes1.com, this is Inside the FLX.
Today we're talking about the Finger Lakes region's 211 Lifeline program. Last Friday was National 211 Day, and we thought it would be a great time to bring in Program Director Deb Turner to talk about the work they do, how their operation has evolved over the years, and just how many people are served every day by this vital service. Check it out.
So 211 Lifeline is a mission program of Goodwill of the Finger Lakes. And so Goodwill, you know, the stores, you know, we have other areas at Goodwill as well that bring in revenue. But a portion of those dollars that, you know, shoppers and donors give to go to funding my mission. And 211 Lifeline, the program itself, provides information referral for human services. It also provides crisis counseling and suicide prevention services 24/7. It's a completely confidential and free service for anyone to use. So people will either dial 211 to get a hold of us. They'll text 898-211 to get a hold of us. They can also go on our website at 211lifeline.org and they can get a hold of us. They can, you know, request an email. They can chat with us. And also our database, which houses comprehensive information referral services. So that means it's human services, government services, that is really geared towards being able to provide help to individuals for a variety of different needs. You know, we get calls that can look like someone in need of housing or food, shelter, counseling services. You know, I don't know where my local WIC office is. So we house all of those resources in our database. It's free to search also on our website.
So I guess the obvious follow-up to that, especially for the layperson who's just, maybe this is their first exposure to the program, yeah, is how on earth does the program organize all of that? Because there are a lot of services. You're talking about a lot of moving parts, a lot of changing parts. So how does sort of the back end of this work to be able to bring all of these things together under one umbrella?
That's a fantastic question. So there is a lot of work behind the scenes that goes into both managing the resource database. So we have an entire team just dedicated to keeping those resources up to date. So at minimum, they're making contact with providers to just check in, you know, hey, are your hours the same? Is the phone number the same? Hey, do you still require X, Y, and Z documents in order to apply for these services? Because we want to make sure that when people are engaging human services, that they know what to expect. Because it's really scary sometimes the first time reaching out to get help. So it's just really helpful to have all that nitty-gritty information. So we have a dedicated team that just does that. So that's just the back end of the resource database. Also, what guides it is we are accredited by what's called Inform USA. It used to be called AIRS, which is Alliance Information Referral Services. And it dictates, you know, how we manage the database. You know, what kind of terms are we attaching certain services to? So for example, when someone calls in, they don't know this is all in the background, but our team is trained on using something called taxonomy terms. So when, say, you call in, you say, hey, you know, I'm looking for some rental assistance. Okay, so then we will plug into our database, you know, we'll be asking for your zip code, for your age, we'll be asking, you know, a couple other questions just to kind of help us get a sense of just not that resource you're looking for, but if there's other resources you may be eligible for. And so we're taking in all this information, you know, and we look using your zip code. we're able to pretty much triangulate resources that service your zip code, because some resources are very zip code specific, because we want to make sure when we're giving you a resource that it's going to be helpful. And so our team is trained on how to ask questions, but also how to be a really good listener. And so, you know, there's all that front end experience that a caller may be getting is a warm voice, an empathetic voice, someone who's listening, you know, hey, you know, what prompted your call today? Hey, you know, I'm hearing that you have a lot of concerns. Which one is like your primary concern? Mm-hmm. And then from there on the back end, you know, we are searching those taxonomy terms, which can feel very, you know, academic-y and heavy, but it's nothing that that person seeking help has to know about.
Right.
So it's like rental assistance, or, you know, during the pandemic, we had very specific resources helping with COVID-19. So it would say, you know, like rental assistance and then the little star mark, I always forget what it's called, COVID.
Yeah.
You know, so there's all this work on the back end that goes to even just managing this huge database. It has over 7,200 different resources just for our region.
Oh my gosh.
So there's that, you know, the resource department, that's that they, you know, manage all of that, alongside with the website. And so the website, there's a ton of thought that goes into how do we make sure that it's easy for people to use. You know, when we're helping list resources, we actually rewrote a lot of our descriptions to be at a second reading grade level, because that was feedback we got, is that when people are looking for resources, they may have some literacy issues. And so that was the best standard, was, you know, rewriting a ton of our descriptions to make sure a second grader could read it and understand it.
Wow.
So there's a lot of thought. There's a lot of feedback. There's so many standards and guidelines that go into just the database portion of what we do. And then there's, of course, the operations side. You know, we have a ton of frontline team members, and we make sure that, you know, we have supervisors that can support them. We have unit leads assigned that can, you know, jump on to, we use Teams platform to like ask questions or like, hey, I need an assist on this call. You know, our supervisors can jump right into those calls and listen live and provide immediate coaching and support. So there's even a ton on the operations end of ensuring, you know, how we're managing, you know, our service levels, how we're scheduling people, how we're providing the live support needed to be able to handle some of these contacts. Because what may become a very basic phone call of like, hey, you know, I was just calling to get some food pantries, sometimes evolves into a crisis mental health call where someone is really having a hard time coping, you know, with a job loss, with family loss, with, you know, all these long-term impacts of COVID, that sometimes these basic needs calls flip into crisis calls. I know that was a very long answer. I'm sorry.
Well, and I'm appreciative of that lengthy answer, because I think, frankly, people need to understand the amount of effort that goes into administering something like this. But I'm just kind of like, I'm thinking about what you just described. And to me, it sounds like, you know, one phone call could potentially require 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different expertises all at once. How many people are actually working on the Lifeline? It sounds like you must have an absolute army, but I'm sure you probably don't have an army, or at least as many as you'd like to have.
Yeah, that is also a great question. So the entire 211 Lifeline program, when I first started about 10 years ago, it was under 30 people. Now we're about 75, 80 people.
Okay.
And we are continuing to
I was going
to
say, if you're still at 30, that's a problem.
Yeah, managing 24/7. And so we have, but that includes like all the supervisors, the unit leads, the resource team. We have trainers. We also have a clinician whose sole job is to provide support for our staff as well, because this job can be, it's hard work, you know, being in the crisis world and in the information referral world.
Yeah. How has the program evolved over the years? And I kind of want to like parse out COVID from this,
yeah.
Just in the general sense. I want to talk about COVID a little more later, but in general, like when you look back over the last 10 years, how's the service evolved?
That's a great question. I don't know if I can take COVID out of it because that's.
If it is that big a piece of it, sure. Like, absolutely.
So being a 30-person or under team, it was really hard. You know, we had less resources. There was, I think, a sense from providers or stakeholders, they couldn't quite put their arms around the value of our services. And, you know, we also had to get better at telling that story. And so COVID, we call some things the gift of COVID. Not that COVID is a gift at all. It was a horrible thing that I would never wish anyone to experience again. But COVID was a real opportunity for Goodwill to make some very strategic decisions about how to invest more into the program. So I give our CEO, Jen Lake, a ton of credit. I remember when we were seeing all these volumes come in, because we saw a 300% increase in contacts and people needing services and answers, because there was so much that we just didn't know about COVID. I remember, you know, I remember we were just grappling with like symptoms and what did symptoms look like and, you know, what services were open and weren't open and, you know, who was going to appointment only versus, you know, that you still could walk in. And so there was just a period of time of so much unknown. And we also didn't understand what funding could look like for response to COVID. But I remember Jen Lake saying, hire as many as you need. And we did. And she took a risk in saying and letting us grow exponentially to be able to meet that need. And so there's definitely that front end experience of like, we hired more frontline people to just respond to calls and take calls.
Yeah.
And then there was, I think, the evolution of partners coming to us and saying, you know, this is too much for us. We need your help. And so we were brought to more tables, which was the first time, really. You know, I think the state, in good intentions, you know, they open up new hotlines, but now they've just wasted millions of dollars opening new hotlines when there's an already established 211 system. We have the infrastructure to increase our call volume. We have the expertise. We have the contacts to, you know, even just the evolution of building relationships with providers. Like, I remember our resource department was working 24/7 during that time just to keep up with all the changes coming in, you know, trying to understand, is this food pantry closing down permanently or temporarily, or are they going to walk in or appointment only? Because there's this balance of we need to meet the community needs, but we also need to make sure that we're not overwhelming those providers as well. And so I think there was an evolution in how we communicated just more impactfully with those entities to build trust. You know, working closely with the health department in Monroe County was huge, you know, that they were struggling. They had so many calls coming in and, you know, our team is trained. We can do triage. We can have hard conversations. We can, you know, if you give us information, we can make sure it gets out. And so we started taking their calls because there was so many coming in. We were contracted for like, oh gosh, like 1,200 calls, and we were easily taking double, triple that amount because the need was there.
Yeah.
And so we built this good relationship with them too, where they were giving us like live changes and information about, you know, quarantine protocols and this is the paperwork you need and just how to navigate some of those tricky situations that our community members were also just trying to grapple with and cope with.
Yeah.
So there was definitely an evolution, I think, in partnership and relationship building that I'm incredibly grateful for, because this huge need and demand came up, like pilots came up. We were piloting, you know, I give kudos a lot to ABC, which is Action for a Better Community, that they had to shut down their weatherization program. And they're like, we have all these big trucks. Like, what if we could just partner with Foodlink and start delivering food? And so they're like, okay, well, how will we know about those community members that need the food? ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
We got tapped and we were able to, you know, push out all these meals. Then, you know, the city of Rochester was like, you know, we have a lot of seniors stuck at home that need meals, and we have restaurants that are going under. How do we meet some needs here, but also, you know, make sure that we help keep these restaurants up and running for our economy? You know, who might have a solution to here? Ding, ding, ding. Yeah. 211. And, you know, so we started doing the senior meal program where we could book good, nutritious meals for seniors to get. And then, you know, the rental crisis started unfolding. You know, like, oh my gosh, like, who can we get to take all these screening calls? Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
And so there was a really wonderful evolution of partners coming to us, needing some help, and then us collaborating and being able to come up with solutions that just made sense.
Running a program like yours, what was the biggest lesson you learned coming out of the pandemic?
That's a big question. The biggest lesson. I feel like there's so many lessons. I think both personally and professionally, there was a huge realization that everyone is trying the best they can with the tools that they have. I think there were a lot of high stress situations that came up. Yeah. You know, all those wonderful dings, you know, they came with, to a level, an emotional cost. You know, like, I remember working 12-hour days, you know, if I was lucky, 5 days a week, but sometimes 6 days a week, because it was just, the need was so great and there was so much happening. And I knew it wasn't forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so me and my team worked so hard, and emotions would get heightened, and it would be really hard to remember to just step back and to self-regulate your emotions a bit. And I learned this trick of, instead of getting frustrated, I'm going to get curious. You know, let me take a step back and get curious about things. You know, like, why would we have that approach? Or why might the staff member be struggling in this way? And it really, I think for me, taught me a better way of handling both the high stress, but also coming up with solutions instead of getting stuck in the things I couldn't do. And I remember that, I think, being a really powerful trick in the moment to just, you know, like, okay, I have these feelings about whatever situation, but I'm going to be curious about it instead, because that's going to be more fruitful than me getting really frustrated about things.
Yeah. Call volume in the last couple of years. What does the average look like?
Yeah. So post-pandemic, it has started to go down, which is good. It means some things are stabilizing. We're seeing between 300 to 500 calls a day, just depending on what's going on. You know, we also try to match our staffing levels to that. You know, some days are much busier than other days. Some shifts are significantly busier than other shifts. You know, we tend to see during the daytime information referral calls come in. And then in the evenings, it starts to go more into the crisis calls. So we get more crisis calls in the evening and the overnight time. And so it's always interesting, that question, because it's just, it depends too what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to staffing, I'm sure that's information that you guys are kind of evaluating on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. We use a phone system that is really helpful with that. Also during the pandemic, we upgraded our phone system because, you know, we needed another change, yeah. But it was completely worth it. You know, we're able to just kind of analyze, like, okay, you know, like, we're seeing some more volume come in on this day. You know, maybe we need to staff up or adjust schedules this direction. You know, sometimes we'll know about events ahead of time. You know, for example, this last summer, we responded to the Ontario County flooding. And, you know, especially with disaster situations, we're able to say, hey, you know, there's some extra hours. People want to do overtime. You know, here's the hours that we need. Like, hey, you know, we're expecting, you know, more calls to come in around this time. Can people stay? So we're able to kind of try our best, especially with things that we know about, to prepare ahead of time.
Yeah. Changes in the why people are calling. You mentioned kind of like the daily shift of what that looks like. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, in the post-pandemic world, like what that trend looks like overall compared to, say, 2018, 2017, the why. What are the most common whys for people giving you guys a call?
That's a good question. So the whys themselves haven't necessarily changed. And the reason that I say that is because I think, I don't know if this is a gift of COVID or just kind of a consequence. COVID really blew open issues that were brewing for quite a while. They were always there. It wasn't like COVID happened and all of a sudden they were an issue. You know, I think specifically the top reasons people reach out to us is because they're in need of housing resources, which can look like rental assistance. You know, they got back on their rent. You know, we've also been seeing people reaching out needing services because inflation, mm-hmm. you know, particularly around housing and affording housing. You know, that if anything, that has increased, you know, that issue was always there and it just bubbled more because of the pandemic. We still get a lot of calls about food, you know, people needing access to food resources. Transportation resources is also a big one. So really, it didn't necessarily change exactly what people are calling about. If anything, it just change the amount of people that are calling out about that now.
I'm curious, in light of that answer, how often are policymakers, electeds, approaching you guys and asking, not for the data, but about your experience? Because it seems like better than most, you guys have a pulse on the community and in a way that, frankly, I'm not many would, many organizations would, in so many different ways. Is that a conversation that's kind of regular or perhaps not as frequent or robust as you'd like?
So definitely with like our United Ways, we send them county reports and we list both like what needs were met and what needs were unmet. So we actually track too, like, hey, you know, if people are calling about this, you know, why wasn't the need met? And so we track that as well. And so we do send those reports out and they have been like looking at them and utilizing them. And I know particularly for United Way, they think about what kind of impact areas they need to start funding in the next round. And so that makes, you know, that makes a difference. We do have like senators and assemblymen who absolutely like reach out asking about data. Actually, last week, Friday, we hosted a 2-in-1 celebration event because 2/11, you know, February 11th, yeah. Was unfortunately a Sunday, so we couldn't host people on the actual day, but we wanted to have a conversation with those decision makers about the impact of 2-in-1, but also things that we're seeing as needs. Right. Because we can slice and dice our data in a way that breaks down different districts. And so we do have a tool on our website called 2-in-1 Counts where the decision makers can go in and actually look based on their district by zip code and all of that, what are the needs? Of course, the data shared on 2-in-1 Counts is very limited for privacy reasons, but they can see like what are people calling about.
Yeah. Couple of questions here to wrap things up. The mental health crisis is, we have a bunch of conversations coming up here on the program over the next month and a half, about various, ways that different organizations, different entities are trying to raise awareness, educate folks, et cetera. When it comes to the mental health crisis, what are a couple of the things that stand out to you in your work and what you see every day?
Yeah, so also my program, 2-in-1 Lifeline, we are the local 988 contact center. And so if people don't know what 988 is, it's another 3-digit dialing access number specific for people in behavioral health crisis, or they just also don't know what to do.
Right.
988, it used to be the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, that 1-800-273-TALK. And they shifted to pretty much rebranding to 988 to make it more inclusive and comprehensive around crisis. Because the truth is, like, the way that we view crisis at 211 Lifeline is it's anything that just throws people off that they can't cope with. It could be something that someone may view as significant or insignificant. You know, I remember one of the counselors sharing a story about, you know, a teenager that called and they lost their rubber eraser that their mother gave to them before she died of cancer. And, you know, to someone to hear, like, you lost your rubber eraser, get over it. But for that person, like, there's a deep seed of grief that has led them to this point of crisis and they need to talk about it. So I think that's also an important element to highlight, is that crisis is it's very subjective. And so we view crisis and we're very flexible to people and what they view their crisis to be. But getting back to 988, 988 is really intended for anyone. They don't have to have thoughts of suicide to reach out. And if you ever wanted me to come back just to speak specifically to 988, I'd love to. I'd be happy Definitely. To. Yeah. Maybe bring some friends along. But there has been a huge shift, I think, for in particular the federal and the state level to take crisis centers more seriously, because we were woefully underfunded for such a long time. And we're so grateful that, you know, now we're included in the governor's executive budget. So there's funding coming into my center to support operations. And that was something we never had before. You know, I think they're being smarter about solutions to deal with crisis and they're listening to us now, where people call in and we can provide them different options, because we've been doing this for such a long time. We've been doing this crisis work since at least 2005, you know, just Goodwill itself. So someone reaches out, we can offer them different services outside of 911. Our last objective is ever to get 911 involved, because it can be more traumatizing and not helpful and also unnecessary. Yeah. You know, those emergency responders need to be at emergencies. And so what we can offer is something like, hey, you know, let me look in your area. Maybe I could deploy a mobile crisis team out to you to talk to you, a mental health professional to come out and talk to you instead of police. That there's been a lot of respect for that shift. And there's been also more funding to support those teams, to start building up those teams to go out instead of police. I don't know if that was exactly your question, but
yeah,
I feel like
yeah.
That's an important highlight within crisis that has been evolving.
Yeah. And I wanted to end on a positive note, or as positive as you can be with such a heavy topic in general, but important program. And I'm curious, when you look at everything as a whole, what's one positive trend line that you see that makes you feel not only good about the work you're doing every day, but that the work is really having an impact and maybe, you know, hitting some of these issues in an impactful way?
I think of stories. You know, like, the data itself is important. Like, we're seeing more people reaching out, especially for 988. You know, it's kind of a double-edged sword of like, well, you know, is that a good thing? It's like, no, it is, because it's encouraging people to reach out potentially before it becomes more serious. It becomes more lethal, frankly, you know. But I think about just stories that I get to hear from my staff on the front lines about, you know, people calling back to thank us. Like, thank you for just listening and for caring and for picking up the phone. You know, thank you for helping me have that conversation with my loved one that I didn't know how to start. You know, thank you for literally saving my life, that we get some of those kinds of thank you calls. And that to me is always a highlight of just, you know, we think about the stress of the operations and the budgeting and, you know, my work going out in the community and building trust, that it's a lot of emotional work. So when I get to hear that someone actually called back and said, thank you for saving my life, that makes it all worth it, like even for that one person. So I hope that's kind of the positive hope you get to hear. But it's just, it's connecting back to the why, like, why are we doing this work? And it's to save lives.
Yeah. Whether someone needs services or is just curious, what's the best way to learn about everything you guys do and see sort of in directory style, everything you guys have going on?
Yeah. So, I mean, Goodwill does have a website. You can look up Goodwill, the Finger Lakes. They do break down all their different programs. If you want to just kind of get a sense of, you know, how things are going, I think following our social media channels is a great way to do it. You know, we have a YouTube channel. We have Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest. Like, we have all these different avenues that people can, you know, get to kind of see what Goodwill is doing. You know, from, hey, you know, we have thriftfluencers, like influencers, who do like fun DIYs, all the way to highlighting some of the work that we get to do every day in our mission programs. But we do have other mission programs at Goodwill I think people would be interested to learn about. You know, we have our Good Neighbor program that we work very closely with, where there's certain locations that people can walk into at Goodwill stores and get services and get help with service navigation. That's huge. You know, we have Goodwill Vision Enterprises, where people can get vision screenings, you know, not just those that are, you know, technically legally blind, but who may be struggling with their vision. You know, they have some youth programs to help youth who have or are currently losing their vision. You know, what are my options, career choices, you know, as I grow up and this new reality of having to cope with this? And so Goodwill does so much work, good work, and they're definitely more than a store. And I would encourage people to follow social media channels, check out our website. Or if they're curious too, they're welcome to call, you know, the services and just ask some questions. You know, we may ask a few questions. People are more than okay if they're like, I don't want to answer. You know, we're not in the game of trying to force people to answer questions they don't want to answer. Sure. But if they're curious, you know, call us and ask us. Services are about.